Okay. Ecclesiastes, and we're in chapter 9. Begin chapter 9. We finished chapter 8 last week, and we talked about the what we had to confess was our inability to always understand what God does, why He does it, and, you know, all these those things going on. Some of those things are beyond, clearly they're beyond our human understanding, and sometimes God, even in His divine revelation, does not tell us those things. So we must trust Him because of who He is. Kind of tied in with my sermon Sunday night that many of you missed, and I'll have to talk to you about that later. But
So
chapter 9. Let's begin looking at this, and there's a word here. I'm running out of space up here with all my announcements. There's a word here I want you to think about right now. Did I spell that right? Okay. I didn't put the E in there. Yay, me. So, judgment. What does that make you... Just tell me for a few moments. What's that, when you see that word, what does it make you think of? In any realm. It doesn't have to be theological. Any realm. Judgment.
Court.
What is that?
Court.
Okay.
Examination.
What's that?
Punishment.
Examination.
Justice
goes with that. Okay. Any other thoughts?
Discernment.
Discernment.
Yeah, there you go. That's the word. I'm
yeah,
asking.
Discernment. Certainly, that word is goes with both of those things. Certainly has a different connotation from the other ones, but discernment is a part of that judgment. Okay.
Because otherwise, I can get really petty in my judgment.
Well, and that would be the question. Or when we use this word, we have to put a little of a qualifier on it. Are we talking about from our perspective, or that which comes toward us? Mm-hmm. In other words, what goes out from us or what comes toward us? It may change how we look at this work. Okay? Or let's see what he says here. Remember, this is the preacher, and he's writing these things. He's trying to understand, basically, life.
Mm-hmm. What chapter are we in?
We're in chapter 9. And he is given his teaching here to help us understand how he works through this. I always like to say that about Ecclesiastes. He's working through this with you. And I say that because that doesn't mean that every statement is a statement of, how do I want to say, a way to go.
Is the final statement?
His final statement is, yeah. He'll make conclusion. But as he's going through this, his point is that he's dealing with life. He's dealing with the struggles like we all do. And he's trying to evaluate them with us. And then he'll come to his concluding statement, which is ultimate understanding.
It's sort of like he's thinking out loud.
Yeah, or he's doing a sermon, like I said. Mm-hmm. He made opening statement. We're in the middle of the meat of the sermon, and he'll make a closing statement. His opening statement is all his vanity. He's going to work through that whole thing, and he's going to end up saying what really matters. And that's how he's going to pull this together. So, chapter 9, he said, "For I considered all this in my heart so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything that is before them. Everything occurs alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good, to the clean, and to the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. As he who takes an oath is as he who fears an oath." All right, so you're going to pull this together. What would be a New Testament verse or saying that would tie into what he just said here? Is there one that runs through your mind?
The rain falls on the just.
On the just and the unjust. Okay. Life is an interesting journey. Would you agree with that? And sometimes we sit around trying to figure out why. And as we looked last week, sometimes we're not given the answer to why. From our perspective, this matter of judgment, usually what we do when we can turn into Job's friend very easy when bad things are happening to somebody else. And put ourselves in the place of judgment and say, you know what, brother? If you just had enough faith, this wouldn't have happened. Or if you just wouldn't have done this, This wouldn't have happened. I mean, and we can, you know, even if we don't know what they did, you know, Job's friends finally said, you know, they said over and over, well, you must have done something wrong or you wouldn't be in the mess that you're in. But that's, you know, that was an ancient thought. It was a thought in the time of Jesus, the man that was born blind, and his disciples' first question, or the only question we have from his disciples to Jesus about this poor blind man was, who sinned? Did his parents sin or did he sin that he was born blind? I'm thinking, and we say, well, what kind of mindset thinks that? Yet we do the same thing as we evaluate what other people are going through, and we make judgment not based on what we know, but on what we presume to be the truth about them. Bad things happen to good people. I think Chuck, one of the pastors, not Colson, but
Swindoll
wrote that book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Mm-hmm. And once again, what he tells us here is you really can't judge, and we got to be careful even in our day and time when the approach seems to be that some people think that they have some sort of spiritual ability to discern that someone is not as spiritual as another person because they are going through hard things. And if they were more spiritual, closer to God, they wouldn't have to go through those things, which is kind of a crazy thing. Jesus went through the ultimate. And after Jesus, everyone of the apostles followed suit going through. And so are we to assume that they weren't quite as spiritual as they needed to be? And say, we've got to be very careful with these kind of statements or judgments that are made about particularly our brothers and sisters. What about those Egyptian Christians? Was there something wrong with their faith that they should be found in such a state that these ISIS people would cut their heads off? I mean, we must be better because God hasn't allowed us to have our heads cut off. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we'll look at Christians in third world countries, our brothers and sisters in third world countries that are just living day to day and barely living day to day. And we Western Christians at times will assume, we must be better than them because we don't have to struggle like they do. We don't have to worry about where our food comes from. We don't have to worry about a roof over our head. Sometimes our attitude toward these things comes off that way. And sometimes we would say, well, we're the blessed group. And somehow these people are less blessed. But I guarantee you, if you've ever ministered in a third world country to believers in Christ, you will walk away more blessed than any blessing you'll ever leave behind. And I don't care if you brought your checkbook and gave them every dime that you had. You will walk away more blessed than any blessing. I guarantee it. We're going down to Empalme, by the way, Mexico in July. If you'd like to go, let me know. And it's humid. It's hard work. It's rough. And you're worn out and stuff like that. And these people have nothing. Some of them are still living in mud huts.
How long is that?
We're leaving on a Monday and come back on a Friday. It's July 6th through the 10th. So I guarantee your socks will be blessed. Your socks will be blessed off. Is that how you say that? Whatever. But we need to be very careful when it comes to this. There's the assumption that if you have enough faith or you're spiritual enough, you'll never suffer want. You'll never be sick. You'll never be poor. And this, of course, is a movement in too many people's minds today in the body of Christ. He says here, these things happen to both groups. I mean, so what do you do about someone who's filthy rich and as ungodly as he can possibly be? You ever asked that question of prosperity preachers? You know, if the evidence of God's blessing upon you is prosperity, well, what do you do with someone who's just as nasty and ungodly as he can be? And what they will tell you, if you've never done a study on them, what they'll tell you is that God has set up some immutable principles that anybody can tap into. Believers and unbelievers. It's called like the force of faith. Faith is not a force.
I don't know, I've
folks.
Those idols, and that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Being idols.
Right. Or having faith in your faith, or it's metaphysics. It's all kinds of things, you know. Rather than walking in relationship with God. Many times people in this world don't get to choose their station in life. None of you chose to be born in America. Okay, so again, once again, are we better? Is that why we were born in America?
No, you know? I'm really grateful. So, I really am. I wish everyone could live like America, yeah. But, you know.
So we have to make sure that we understand what he's trying to say here. And be sure to understand that even here we have people that are suffering and going through sickness and stuff. And there's this little feeling in the back of some of their head, because I've talked to a lot of them, is that, what am I doing wrong? Am I not believing enough? I'm not praying hard enough? I'm not, you know, like this. And somehow that gets in people's head. But what if it is God's plan for you or for me to go down that path? Like the martyrs, that was God's plan. They went down that path. What if sickness is God's path for me or for you, so that down that path of sickness he might use us to touch lives that would never be touched if we didn't go down that path? Who's able to make such judgment that it's not God's thing? Especially in the absence of clear scriptures that say, you know what, if you believe enough you'll never have to suffer, you'll never have to hurt, you'll never have to be hungry, you'll never have to be sick. There's no scripture to teach that. All right. So here we again. That's what he's trying to tell us here. These things happen to both the righteous and the wicked. You know, you go into a cancer ward today and you see people getting their chemos and stuff like that. If you did an evaluation through there, you'd probably get some believers, some unbelievers, some believers, some unbelievers. That cancer is not a discerner of who it attacks. Can God heal sickness? Of course he can. There's nothing impossible with God. So, you know, can God pour into someone's life great blessings? He can, but be very careful that you don't make that the standard by which you judge someone's spirituality. Because it could be, again, that God would decide for me, I'm going to take everything away from you and I'm going to use that for my glory. We only assume that when good things happen, God is glorified. God is glorified regardless. Regardless. And it's God who's in control, not us. So we must remember that. And you know, whether our life is one filled with great blessings and not having to hunger, not being threatened and all that stuff, then we must serve God in that situation. But if God decides that that's not where we're going to be, we must serve God in that situation. And so, he reminds us of that. Someone else had. I thought I saw a hand going up. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking of. I was reading an article today about church in Nepal. You know, it's a very minority Christian. They're a very big minority there, but they lost 80 members because it happened during service. During the service, they were having.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the roof came down and 80 of their members perished. You know.
Yeah. Well, look what he says in verse 3. He says, "There, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all." From man's perspective, that doesn't make sense to us. Right? How often have you ever done this to God? I don't need testimonies. I just want you to think about it. I don't put anybody on the spot. How many times you say, "Well, God, why am I going through this? You know, I've been faithful, and I've been faithful with my giving. I've been faithful with my service. I've been faithful with my prayers and stuff like that. So why am I going through this?" Have you ever asked God that question in those moments when you're struggling? And it's not an uncommon question. I think, you know, when we're going through that, many times that's where we'll find ourselves. So we have the... Think about it. When we make those statements to God, we have the assumption if we do everything right, then somehow God is obligated to do everything right toward us.
And normally, back to work to answer again. That question, yeah. Or reveal that afterwards.
If you're sensitive. I mean, if you're open to what he wants to say, yeah.
But normally he... But what did I go through?
Right. But the point about this is, if you think about it, that is really how we think as human beings. That is a normal thought process. And you know, if we're not careful, sometimes we offer the gospel to people that way. If you come to Jesus, everything will be all right. If you come to Jesus, everything will be as it should be. And some people respond to that and they find out that, hey, someone lied to me. Because for some people, when they came to Jesus, life actually got harder for them. Because some people had to sacrifice relationships and former things that they enjoyed and stuff that they had to set aside and stuff because they came to the Lord and stuff. It wasn't an easier thing for them. It was a harder thing for them. So we need to be honest. Jesus never said, come follow me and I'll make life easy for you. He said, in this world, you, my followers, will face trials and tribulation.
Up your cross and
that's right, and he said, if you're going to be my follower, you must first deny yourself, take up the cross, and follow me. So he gave a clear cut. If you want to follow me, it's going to cost you. And a man, by, how many of you ever heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Okay, there's a nice book out there. It's not a hard read. It's a one. He's pretty good. He's a theologian from the 40s. 30s and 40s, but he wrote a book that's pretty. I enjoy reading it. It's a challenging book to me. It's called The Cost of Discipleship, and one of his statements in there is it says when God calls a person, he calls them to come die. So, and then he talks about that cost of discipleship in that book. You can get it at Amazon. There are probably copies everywhere. It's a paperback. It's so. I think you'll enjoy reading it if you will. And it cost Bonhoeffer. He was over in the name sounds a little bit German to you. It should, because he was over there and it cost him. His faith cost him during that time. So.
Well, a lot of prophecies, especially in the times, it says, you will suffer in my namesake. So right there it says that
right.
Being a Christian is not going to be easy. You're going to suffer for my name.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, you, Mary. I'm sorry, Mary. Go ahead.
Careful, I forget what I was going to say. I was thinking of Paul. How God called Paul, because when he sent Ananias, he said, "You know, I'm going to tell. I want you to tell him how much he is going to suffer for me.
For my
name's sake."
Right. And Paul, he said, "I know what's waiting for me when I go there." But he had to go there. I mean, think about that. If you knew, most of us, here's how we do it. We say, if we knew that what was going to be waiting for us there was beatings, jail, just being put upon by persecuted stuff, we'd say, apparently that's not God's will for me. How many American, I call them Western Christians, discern God's will only by what is the easiest, best, and what we consider to be the most blessed path? Think about what I'm just saying to you. We evaluate that it must be God's will if it's filled with easy, if it's easier, if it's blessed. What if God calls you to be like Paul? See, that kind of statement from Paul tells me that he was listening to the Holy Spirit rather than looking at the circumstances. And the church today, what we usually do is we look at the situation. And then we evaluate God according to the situation. We don't go to God and say, God, would you have me go? And I've had parents tell me before when their kids were heading off to mission work in some places that could be quite dangerous and stuff. And they say, Christian parents say, I don't know how they could go there. There's so many other places they could go. And I try to tell them, I want people to get this and believe it. The safest place for a child of God to be is wherever God has called them to be. And it ultimately doesn't matter what's going on around that situation. If God has called them there, that doesn't mean that we're not going to be concerned and pray. Of course we are. But you know what? If God has called you over to Saudi Arabia, okay, and you decide you're going to stay in Fountain Hills, I'm going to say it's probably going to be more dangerous for you in Fountain Hills than in Saudi Arabia. It's hard for us to see it that way. But, you know, to me, Paul's faith is an amazing faith where he would say, I know what's waiting for me when I go to that community. I know what they're going to say, you know. And sometimes we Christians even do that in our own safe community. We don't speak up for the Lord. We don't share our faith. We don't stand on what we know to be true and right because we're worried that a neighbor next to us who don't care a flip about you anyway is going to say that they don't like you. It's always funny. We care so much about what people who don't care anything about us say, and seem to care so little about what the Lord thinks about us. All right, let's go on. He says, so. He says this is evil, that word evil there means it just doesn't seem right. He's not talking about the devil and evil. He's talking about this doesn't play out right when he says evil, okay? He goes on and said, truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Now, that evil has more to do with contrary to God. Okay? Madness in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. That's okay. You might want to put that on your gravesite. I don't know your gravesite. So, what would he be saying about that? Well, you could take it from a very positive thing and say, well, where there's life, there's hope. You could take it from a very fatalistic point of view, where there were some, and I'm sure Solomon had a struggle with this too. I'm not sure of all the awareness that Solomon had about eternity. I know he trusted the Lord. I'm just not sure they understood all the awareness of that, and the thought of, you know what, it's better to be alive and still have a shot at it than to be dead and have no shot at it, and even the thought of being dead and not even being anymore. So I don't know what he's struggling with there, but once again, from the view of man, here's what I find interesting, that when I'm dealing with most of human nature, unless something's completely off and completely wrong, we struggle for life with every fiber of our being. Even we Christians, we know, and we have the assurance that we have eternal life. Yet God, I believe God has put something in us that makes life precious to us. So when life is cut short or it's over, particularly when loved ones happen, you know, in our life, there's a reason why it hurts so much. You know, even we Christians who say, well, I'm going to get to see them, you know, in heaven. And we know we're going to get to see them in heaven, but there's something there. And then also what we do is we hang on to life as much as we can, unless something's completely off and we take our own life, and I would think in most of those cases, there's a hope that, you know, that it doesn't quite happen. You can't figure out everything's going on in a person's mind, but God has made us for life. That's the point. And death is completely the opposite of who we are. Remember, God made man for himself, and it wasn't until man sinned that death entered into the scene. And the Bible calls death the last enemy. So the point there is that death is opposed to us. And I say it's opposed to us not merely from a spiritual sense to we who are born again. I think it's opposed to humanity, mankind, because we were made to be alive. And overall, you can see this. Even we talk about people who have nothing, and they're surviving, eating off of garbage dumps and stuff like that in parts of the world and stuff. They're still dragging themselves out there. They're still digging through this nasty stuff just to get a few morsels of food. And sometimes, again, we Western go, well, you know what? Who could live like that? Well, you've never had to be that place where you could live like that. And I hope we never have to. I do. But isn't it interesting that to them, if that's what they have to do to live, that's what they'll do to live? Because there's something within mankind that hangs on to life. If you ever sat with someone who's dying, you'll see that. Even though the time will come when their spirit, if you will, their soul will leave them and stuff. But boy, in the hospice houses that I've sat in and stuff, people hanging on. June.
It's kind of like a process when, like, somebody is told that they have a terminal disease and they go through these different stages.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was a Baptist minister, and when he got ill, one of us girls would go and stay with him. He didn't want to stay at home alone. But then as he got closer to going home, then he said, I don't need you girls anymore. I'm okay. And he was looking forward to it. And mm-hmm. God gives us the grace. No matter how bad we want to hold on to this life, when our time comes, he gives us the grace.
Right. He does. And I think that's part of his great promise to us. But within us, he's also put the desire to live.
It's
so it's kind of interesting. It's interesting to watch anyway. So you ever thought about what it's going to be like when it's your time? Oh, now he's getting morbid. You know? Yeah, you just want to go. Well, I'm up for the rapture. I'm up for the rapture too. You know? I just think that'd be cool. I know, but anyways, but
there's an old quote from Woody Allen. He says, "I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens."
Yeah. So, you know. So that's the thing I think about a lot. I've sat with a lot of people when they pass, including parents and stuff, and you just wonder. You just wonder what that's like and what they're immediately seeing. And we know that we have the promise of God, but still, we don't know. We've never seen.
We used to call it the glow.
Yeah.
The what? The glow. Some people, especially like in the what's the word I'm looking for? I can't think. The homes that, you know, where we have patients that were getting close to the end of the time, they get the certain glow.
Yeah.
Certain, and hospice patients, they get the certain glow about them, and you knew that it was time.
Yeah.
That it was very.
And so some of them go the opposite way. They call it a death mask.
Well, yes. But those that know
yeah.
God,
yeah.
they get this glow.
It is an interesting thing. I can't explain all of it. So I don't make any of it the norm, but I can't explain all of it. I've shared what happened when my dad died. It was an amazing thing, and we got there, and Dad was in a nursing home in Mesa, the guy had just done the walkthrough. The attendant had just done the walkthrough. And he looks back down the hallway, and these lights are going off in Dad's room. Well, there's no lights in the room, like flashlight or something like that. And the guy comes back down there to see what it is, and Dad's roommate says, "Well, Dean's over there talking to these people. And they were just in here." And the guy goes over and looks at my dad, and my dad's gone. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. You know, that's one of those things I don't know. I can't explain. I don't know, you know, what happened. I don't know. I mean, the guy had no reason to tell me different, and the guy in my dad's room was telling me, "You wouldn't believe it." I said, "I'll believe anything right now." So, but I don't know. But that certainly didn't happen all the time and stuff. I sat with my mom, and she just slowly went and stopped, you know. So,
I'm reading a book out of our church library, and it's called Heaven by Randy
Alcorn. Yeah, Alcorn.
It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, it's a very. It'll give you some new perspective on heaven if you've never read it. It is. It's a good book. Yeah. All right. So, where are we? Oh, they go to the. Okay. Verse 4. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they who have no reward. For the memory of them is forgotten. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten.
Pastor?
Yeah.
I've heard that verse used for soul sleep.
Yeah.
That know nothing.
Yeah. You know the doctrine of soul sleep? The primary group that believe in soul sleep is the Seventh-day Adventists.
What do you mean? I don't get what you're talking about.
Well, soul sleep.
Sleep, okay.
Okay, the soul being asleep.
Yeah, that is conscious. Yeah.
And so what they teach is that when we die, our soul remains in a sleep or an unconscious state until the resurrection. But they are theologically wrong. Jesus made it very, very clear that that those who pass from this life have complete consciousness. The rich man in hell or Hades knew what was going on. Lazarus knew what was going on. And why would Jesus tell the thief on the cross, if he was going to go to sleep and tell the resurrection, why did Jesus tell him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise"? It would make no difference to him. So, again, and what they'll use some verses in the New Testament where Paul will use the term sleep for death. And by the way, when Paul uses the term sleep, he's talking about the physical body. He's not talking about the soul of man. Okay? And so, but they're interchangeable. It's making something out of something that's not there. So, and they'll use verses like this where these guys struggle. Old Testament people struggle with what happened when people die. You know, I won't feel anything. You know, why would David? But you, every once in a while you have clarity, you know, where like David says, when his child died, he said, he can't come to me, but I can go to him. Well, if he was going into nothingness, why would it make any difference that he could go to where his son was? You know, Job said, I know that my Redeemer liveth, and on the earth one day shall stand. Why would he make such a statement if after life, after death, we go into nothingness? So, you know, there are statements, but there are also, that's why I love the Bible so much. It's so honest. You have Solomon here who's struggling with these things, dealing with these things, trying to understand these things. Solomon had never been dead before. How does he know completely? Same thing for us. You know, we know what the Bible says. We believe what it says and stuff, but we still have to deal with how we're looking at that and how we're going to receive that. You know, I think it's the person who thinks they know all about what it's going to be like, what it's going to be like going through it and stuff. They're the ones that are fooled the biggest. You know, it's like even with God. I'm convinced that when we get to see him face to face, the first thing that's going to hit us is, God, I'm sorry for how little I thought of you. I made you so small, and you wanted me to know you better, and I didn't. I personally think it's part of him wiping away the tears. You know, because I certainly wouldn't want to spend eternity looking at my God in regret for how little I thought of him here on earth. Can you imagine that? That wouldn't be heaven. That would be. You know, but he's not going to let that. He's not going to let guilt be there. He's not going to let disappointment be there. He's not going to let any of those things be there. He's going to wipe. When he says he's going to wipe them away, he's going to wipe them away. So, all right. Any other thoughts before we move on? Okay. Verse 6. Also, their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. So that statement makes sense. They will not experience the things that life has for them. They're gone, and they have no hope. But they have no pain. But they also have no hope. These are the good series of verses if you want to talk about reincarnation. Okay, that we don't come back, and we don't live multiple lives. The Bible, as a matter of fact, Hebrews makes that clear. It says, it's appointed for man to die how many times?
Once.
And after that, the judgment. Okay, so the Bible makes it very clear that reincarnation is not even close to being an acceptable thought for a Christian. You're given, somebody said before, you and I are given one shot at this. You know, that's why sometimes we hate time. Because we would love to be able to go back and do things different. All of us have regrets. Maybe treat someone different, make different decisions than we made before, whatever. But time doesn't allow that, does it? You know, we're living it. Okay. Now, what would his advice be if he could give it? Well, by the way, I'm going to say this is not a bad advice unless it's the way you live your life all the time. What he's about to say. Well, and so he says, go eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. So, this is not a call to a lifetime of partying. But you know, part of life, which unfortunately some sad-faced Christians, some killjoy Christians, somehow think it's sinful to have any joy in life. And I think that's terrible. And we've been in third world, seems like what's easy for people to go have a good time here, but even in third world, you catch those glimpses in the midst of poverty, you catch the glimpses of laughter and fun. You know, and when we go out there in Haiti and stuff, we're carrying these paper bags with this old lunch meat and cheese on lunch meat with a little bit of mayo on them, and we got these bag of, they want to call them cheese puffs. They're puffs, all right, but they're not close to Cheetos. They're more close to those foam things you put in packages. Okay, packing peanuts. Well, you sit down there. And we always, my practice is, and practice of a lot of people there, we always bring extra sandwiches. Well, we bring them for the workers that are helping us, the Haitian workers. But there's always kids around. And to give them half of a sandwich, and you see just a little bit of joy in their face, you know, for most of our kids in our, it's, oh, I don't eat that, you know, type of thing, you know, but.
To them, it's filet mignon.
Yeah. So, but then to see them find an old tire rim and take a stick and run it down the road with that stick and stuff, or some beat up ball that's been taped up and all this stuff that our kids are going, oh, that's no good, I'll throw it away. And they'll spend the afternoon playing that and laughing and stuff.
There's a YouTube video out, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's the one where some photographer, he purposely went over to Africa and played the Pharrell Williams Happy Happy.
Oh, Happy?
Uh-huh. And it's all impromptu. The music's playing, so you're just seeing their native dancing and it's all different.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube if you look it up.
Okay.
It'll bring tears to your eyes.
How about, I wonder if it isn't... is it Peru or something where they go through the garbage all the time, these young kids, and they've actually made instruments.
Yeah, that's
awesome. Oh yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, I've seen that on YouTube too.
Music, you know.
Yeah. So, I guess my point is this: what we do sometimes, again, Western Christians, what we do sometimes is someone laughs or smiles or is enjoying their time in the Lord and stuff, or enjoying even life. I mean. Somehow it's not right, you know. I think I shared with you a few years ago, we went to the Christian school that Drew went to and stuff, and went over they planned a trip to Disneyland over there. So we're sitting there and stuff, and about ready to release these kids in the park. So the headmaster of the school stands up and says, well, just remember that not everybody gets to have this kind of happiness and joy and stuff. And don't overdo the fun today. Keep your mind upon spiritual things today and keep yourself in line. And I'm thinking, what? You bring them to the happiest place on earth and then you drop a bomb on them right before they go in the gates. I always have hesitation when I see depiction of Jesus in films, you know, because I always have some hesitation. But there have been some that I think at the same time God has touched my heart with. I thought Cazavelli, who did The Passion, God used that. You know, he really did. When I see him, I don't see Cazavelli doing the thing. So, but I also saw, I can't say his last name right, but you know.
Oh, Caviezel?
Yeah, whatever.
Caviezel, I'm thinking, who's Cazavelli?
Well, it may be in some parts of the world it's Cazavelli. Huh? Never mind. Okay. But then there's also one of the film series where they have a smiling Jesus.
Right.
And I think they carry that a little bit too far. I get a little bit tired of it in the film, but to see that aspect of him, which is not portrayed in very many films at any time. Jesus is always walking around like he just finished, you know, a 3-hour theology class or test and it can't break a smile. I think that's wrong too. I think Jesus enjoyed life.
Well, just from the parables, you know, he had a sense of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know.
So, you know, and I think he enjoyed being with his disciples, and not just in the tense moments or the teaching moments where he was just really laying out some heavy stuff. But you know, we got it written down for us. But what else did he do? What did he do when he was out there on the lake with them and stuff? You know, how, you know, did he ever push one into the water and stuff? Did he hit one upside the head with the old wet fish or something? I don't just see him as just being this stoic, no humor individual. He was a real man. He dealt with all those emotions the same way we did. The difference between him, he didn't let those things control him. If you want to think about Christian faith, we talk about being spirit controlled. And again, we think spirit controlled means I always have to be, you know, a certain way. No, the Spirit is being in control wherever you are. In your celebrations, in your times of joy, in your times of sorrow, in your times of worship, in your time of work. All those things. He's not absent of any of those things. And I think those things that really bring us genuine joy bring the heart of God joy. But again, those things are not to rule us. The Spirit of God is to rule us in those things. And I think that's how Jesus walked his life. He walked. So, Jim, were you going to say something? Okay. Go ahead, please.
The source, right? I mean, this God
and the Spirit, that's the source of the joy.
Yes.
It's not like you have to contain that or rein something back in, right?
And right.
The amount of time that the Son, Jesus, spent with the Father while he was walking on the earth, it was a natural
thing. And our problem is we turn it around and try to make things be our source of joy and then ask God to work in those instead of understanding that God is our source of joy and anything, God's there with us. God's there with us. So, and I do think, I really believe he intends for us to enjoy life. You know, it makes no sense to me to want to spend time with my kids and say, we're just going to sit here and look at each other and every once in a while I'll pop some theological thing at you. So, you know, when my kids are around, I just want to hug them and, you know, kiss them and punch them and all that good stuff, you know, and grandbabies. Ah, there we go. So, all right. So, verse 8, let your garments always be white and let your head lack no oil. Okay. So, again, some people carry that reference to being the garments being white is always being righteous. I guess you could do that, but I don't really know that that's what he's saying there. I think he's saying, you know what? I talked to someone the other day who's pretty depressed, and in the depression, sometimes people will shut themselves off. They won't take care of themselves. They won't get up and get dressed. They won't put on the makeup. You know. And we've all been at one stage of that, one level or another. We don't want to see anybody. We don't want to do anything. We just want to sit there. Don't want to shave. Some of us don't shave much anyway, but we don't want to shave and we don't want to do all those things. But sometimes it's good for someone to just say, you know what? You need to get up and you need to go wash yourself up, shave, put on some clean clothes, get out and do something. Just get out. Don't sit there in the dark. And I see that as more what he's saying here than talking about the white, put on white robes as a mark of righteousness here. He's just saying, get up, get out, and enjoy the life that God has blessed you with. That ties in with everything he's saying here. All of us have been, you know, after, it's kind of like a thing, if we start slipping into isolationism and depression, it's easier for us to stay in there. And sometimes we have to make ourselves. And we don't want to do it when we're doing it. But on the other side of making ourselves, we're usually glad that we did. Because we were not meant to be alone. We were not meant to be that way. Right? Verse 9, he goes on, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. I love how he said, okay. Thank you for that encouragement, Solomon, and go ahead and throw in the empty life that I'm living type thing. So live joyfully, you know, and by the way, that's an option. You can flip that both ways, by the way, husband or wife, but the point with the spouse, okay? It really is. He's kind of giving you an option. You can be miserable all the days of your life, or you can make some decision that you're going to live joyfully with that person. Now, and again, I understand there are all kinds of nuances. Maybe they won't be as joyful. Maybe they won't receive you. Yeah, I know. So, but the encouragement here is to live joyfully. As much as it's like what Paul says in Romans, as much as it depends upon you, you're to live at peace with all people, including the people that are closest to you. Now, that doesn't always depend upon us. There are people that just won't live at peace with you. I understand that, okay? But as much as it depends upon us, we're to live at peace. And that's kind of what he's saying here, too. We have to make that decision. Now, will they reciprocate? Will they respond? That's not guaranteed here, okay? So, life which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Okay? Verse 10. Here's a great verse that you probably heard before. And it really is a way of living life, I think. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Again, this is the opportunity. If you're going to do something, if your life is going to amount to something, you know, and once again, we might have those pensive moments where we sit back and we think about that. You say, Has my life amounted to anything? Have I really made a difference? Have I done everything that God wants me to do? And again, that can do one or two things. That can drive you into depression and say, man, I'm 57 years old and there's more behind me than there is ahead of me, and I've blown a lot of chances, so I'm just going to sit down and eat worms and whatever. or it can be say, you know what? I did miss opportunities. I didn't put my hand really to it when God gave those opportunities. But in whatever time God's given me, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go where He wants me to go. I'm going to say what He wants me to say. I'm going to live life as much as I can in the fullness of the Spirit of God. That's a choice you and I have to make right now. No matter what's happened today or yesterday, you and I get to make that choice today. So tomorrow doesn't have, even if yesterday was bad, tomorrow doesn't have to be bad.
And it's not over yet.
No, it's not over.
The very thing that He may have called you to do specifically in your life may not have happened yet. Everything up until now has been preparing you for that.
And even if you look back at some of the things, I didn't have to do this, I shouldn't have done that, God's bigger than all those things. And he is able to make... I love that Romans 8:28. All things work together for the good to those who love God and call it according... All things. That's not blaming God for things. That's an acknowledgement that God is bigger than the things of our life. And even the decisions of our life. And so if our decision now is to follow Him, there's no telling what He can do, even with wherever we've been. Because that's the kind of God... He's a redeeming God. Restoring God's stormy.
Go, Rob.
Well, you know, the command is to love God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul. And then the second part of that is to love yourself. And part of loving yourself is to forgive yourself, and you make a lot of mistakes. I mean...
Yeah. We're talking about love your neighbor as yourself. But
well,
yeah, part of
you
that.
Love yourself, too. And then you love your neighbor. And
well, yeah.
Well, if you see yourself as God sees you, I think
right. Those qualifiers have to be said there, because for the world to love self is different than what we mean as Christians.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
what does it mean, vanity? I have two different things, but the one, what does it mean by vanity there? Because when I think of vanity, I think of being vain. What does it mean by vanity there?
Vanity means emptiness. Your empty life. You can change that with emptiness.
Meaningless.
And when he says all life is vanity, he's saying all life is empty. When he gets to the conclusion, what he's going to say is only that which God gives you is what life is all about. Everything else, this dissertation he's given here, is he's going through everything under the sun that men go for to try to find meaning in life. And his point is that it's all vanity. It's all empty. And then only God can fill that emptiness.
Well, then that explains the other part where I always think of, and when you talk about depression and that kind of stuff, life being empty, is that God tells us, don't work for man, work for me.
Right.
Because you will constantly let people down, or you feel like you're letting people down. So if you're working for them, it's going to bring you to depression because you're not going to please everybody.
And they're going to let you down.
God, and they're going to let you down, and that's where the depression comes from. So if you work for God, then you know that He will do whatever He does and will make whatever you do.
Like the Bible reminds us, He is faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge word. None of us are faithful in everything.
He'll never fail.
Yeah, He'll never fail. He is faithful in everything. But again, I just want to say, don't transpose what you think He should be doing and then judge Him by what you consider to be His faithfulness. His faithfulness is not according to His performance. That's not how we judge it. His faithfulness is according to His character. As I said Sunday night, love, all-knowing, all-powerful. That's where His faithfulness is. It's found in who He is, not in what He does, because we are so fickle when it comes to what someone does, even God, that we have the tendency to judge something, even a good act of God in our life, we may misjudge it. So we must stand upon who He is, not upon how we view what He does. That's a hard thing for us. It's a hard thing for me. Okay, any other questions? We are out of time. That hour went fast for me. Some of you, I don't know about you, but... All right, so just before you go,